yet I have a bone to pick with it, which is the omission from it of the notions of camp, which I think we hope to come back to possibly later in this discussion. We've got Kai Miller to internationalize us a bit. Greg, of course, was born in Ghana. And you grew up there too, didn't you?
No, I was born in Egypt.
Born in Egypt, grew up in Ghana. And Kai was born in Jamaica and moved to Glasgow, is now, of course, moving to London. So he, too, is on the move is a very fine novelist. I say that, though we're not talking about novels today, and also a wonderful essayist, but more than any of those things, he is a wonderful poet whose latest Carcanet collection, Greg is Carcanet, Chris is Carcanet, you're the only one who's not on the team yet, has been shortlisted for the Forward Prize, and we're very pleased with that. And we have Chris, who was born in... Do you want to tell him a bit about your background?
I was born in London.
Oh, that's boring. But you grew up somewhere.
I grew up in Ethiopia.
In Ethiopia. So he, too, has a kind of international route, a kind of wandering route. His second collection, Ethiopia Boy, was published by Carcanet and was extremely well received. He's published in Poetry Review, Poetry London, The Verb, and so on. And almost my favorite person in Manchester is sitting on my right, Rachel Mann, who describes herself as an Anglican priest, we can tell that from the dog collar, and a minor canon, I can tell you she's not that minor, of Manchester Cathedral. You're a trans woman and lesbian, and you're the cathedral's resident poet, and you've run the Manchester poetry competition, the religious poetry competition, for a couple of years, haven't you? You're the author of a theological memoir, Dazzling Darkness, which appeared 2 years ago, and a collection of stories and poems, The Risen Dust, which is a bit like my resurrection of the body, only longer.
Not as good.
Well, and you're currently writing a PhD on 19th century women's literature and the Bible. So it's a weird and wonderful team. What I find interesting about it is that it is a team that's quite international in lots of ways. I myself am from Mexico and grew up there and was educated there and here. I'd just like to put down a few markers and then invite Greg to speak first and then move around the room, culminating in Rachel. She'll be the first climax of the afternoon, and then there'll be others later on. I myself still, as a writer, feel very ambivalent about the label gay as applied to my own writing and to the writing of other poets that I publish. It seems to compel and prescribe both to the writer and to the reader. And one question I would ask a lot of you is, why did you come to this event? It seems it's a very odd label, as it were, to draw in an audience. I see it hasn't drawn in a huge audience, so so obviously it's not what you would call a selling label. I would like us, if we can, to limit our discussion to writing by self-identified gay people rather than queering everybody. Also people who have identified themselves as gay within the gay period, the legal period. And I would like us to consider possibly, these are just basic guidelines, which we can always transgress, whether certain tones, modes, themes are especially associated with gay writing, if there's such a category, if there are pressures on out gay writers in relation to their theme, subject matter, and so on. I remember Tom Gunn telling me very emphatically that a gay writing has to be affirmative. And I remember resisting that. I remember John Ash resisting a review of his first book which said he's gay but he doesn't write enough about it in the Gay Times. And are there pressures on gay writers? And is a wider politics or set of politics attached to gay writing? So, Greg, over to you, who know about the answers to all these questions.
Well, they're questions that I've been asking myself for 40 years or so. Susan Sontag once said to Edmund White, I think this was back in the 70s, in the mid-70s sometime, she said, "Surely you don't want to be just a gay writer. Don't you want to hit the big time?" And that seems to me to get sort of to the heart of one of the problems with being a gay writer. The sense that you are judged by others to be doing something smaller than real writing. to be portioning yourself off and addressing a minority. And somehow you're seen to be automatically producing something that is a sub-literary genre rather than the real thing, the big time. Sontag herself, of course, was lesbian, but never wrote openly as such. And so, to me, it seems that that question comes from a kind of closet, though she was openly lesbian among her friends, but not in her writing. My feeling is I'm perfectly happy to think of myself as being a gay writer. And obviously, having published a history of gay literature, I'm happy with the idea of gay literature. But there's a few words that I put on my introduction to myself on my website, which, if I may, I'll just quote. I say on there, while I'm happy to think of myself as a gay writer, this is because I have a very broad sense of what such a writer can do. I mean, my history of gay literature, I know you don't want to talk about the earlier period, but my history of gay literature has a chapter on Shakespeare.
And
a chapter on Christopher Marlowe and Dante and a bit of Chaucer and a bit of Proust and so on. So, while I'm happy to think of myself as a gay writer, this is because I have a very broad sense of what such a writer can do. I'm not happy, though, to accept such a label from people who think of it as just a gay writer. Mm. From them, I expect the courtesy of being recognised as just a writer. So, I'm happy with the term unless it's thought by an interlocutor to be insulting and diminishing. So the concept of just a gay writer seems to me to be a homophobic concept. I talked about Edmund White. Now, he was a generation who started writing significantly, really, in the 60s and in the 70s. He and some friends formed a group called the Lavender Quill Group of gay novelists in New York, five or six of them. They only met about six times, but they determined that they would do two things. They would always be openly gay in their work, and they would write for a gay audience. That is to say, they would write about gay people as we, rather than as they. And so it'd be forming a kind of collective voice. They obviously didn't only want to sell to gay people, because there you're limiting your market, you're limiting your income. But they felt that if they wrote well enough, then a non-gay audience was going to be interested. And a non-homophobic audience was going to be interested. They didn't care that they were putting off a homophobic audience. I mean, why would we care? And that's the kind of principle that that a lot of writers have been working with since then. Edmund White himself has, of course, become much more of a crossover novelist. Armistead Maupin, for instance, I think sells much more to straight people than he does to gay people, although his books are so much about gay San Francisco. Yet in this country, when you see someone like Alan Hollinghurst, every time he publishes a new novel, there's always five or six interviews with him in the weeklies. And he's always asked, do you think yourself a gay novelist? And of course he's openly gay, and of course his books are about gay topics, but he never has an answer. He's always embarrassed by that question. Mm. And it seems to me it's about time he sorted himself out and just said, yes, I'm a gay writer.
But you did say something odd yourself there. You said Sontag is not a lesbian in her writing. And I wonder what you mean by that, because it seems to me that her concerns, her astonishing tolerance, her area of interest, her zones of interest, are very sort of cognate with the gay writers, with the lesbian writers, are they not?
Yes, of course, but she's sort of writing within a New York milieu where genius is part of the currency that they're dealing in, and genius is always objective, and she's hardly even explicitly writing as a woman, let alone as a lesbian woman.
But is it perhaps a context in which it's not necessary to do that? In other words, would that not be an ideal situation where it's not necessary to have to do that, where the tolerance was such that it's not required?
Perhaps, yes, but I don't believe that situation exists.
In New York?
Anywhere, no. But, no, I mean, there are parts of New York where I wouldn't walk down the street hand in hand with another man. Hmm.
True. Okay. Chris, do you want to talk a bit about your formation? And you look frightened.
I am. Terrified. Yeah, I brought some notes, but Michael's told me not to read them. So.
Oh, you can do what? No. You do what you wish.
No, I'm probably better off without notes. I was a bit taken by surprise because I don't really think of myself as a gay poet at all. Really, I think of myself as a love poet. What made me realise I was a love poet was reading Whitman, which is outside your period. We two boys together clinging, which I got someone to read at our civil partnership ceremony, and I was in tears, and I think I was the only one in tears actually, but my partner was dry eyed. Anyway, that's the way. I've been writing, really. I feel also a bit of a fraud because I've been writing the last few years about my friend Abebe, who was a childhood friend of mine. He was the son of our cook when we lived in Ethiopia. I was 9 and he was about 16. So there was a vast age gap. And we never had any physical relationship. So what am I doing? But I did love him and I think he liked me. There was sort of electricity going on. And I was just trying to think, well, was there any sex? Well, there wasn't sex, but there was me just gobsmacked by how beautiful he was. Ethiopian men still now pee in the street, and they have a sort of way of doing it, so that they don't actually show you what they're doing. You can't see their penis, but actually if you're a child and you look hard enough, you can. And I remember being absolutely, entranced by that. I've no idea what he thought about it, but anyway, so that was Abebe when he was that age. Then, I didn't see him for a long, long, long time. And I was always thinking about him because Ethiopia's been, just revolution, wars, famines, etc. But I was always thinking about him and in 2007, I thought, well, I've got to do it. I've got to go back. So I went back with my now partner, and we had a lovely time. And on the last day, I found out that Abebe had died. He died of drink, but he'd been a very, a very popular carpenter, maker of cupboards, and a singer, songwriter, he'd never actually married. Which in the sort of very traditional, very religious society that Ethiopia is quite a statement, actually. So my feeling about him, I think, was completely vindicated in a way, and I felt a real devastated grief, but also a real connection again with Abebe, so I wanted to write about him. And I thought, well, am I going to write like, we two boys together clinging? Am I going to write like Walt Whitman, or what am I going to do? And I thought, well, it's got to have something to do with Ethiopia, the way I write this. So I went back to SOAS, the School of Oriental African Studies, and enrolled on an Amharic course to get my Amharic up to a level where I could actually read a bit of Amharic literature and found out about Amharic poetry and their praise poems, especially because that's what really turned me on. They're quite incantatory and they're a bit like Whitman, in fact. So I thought, well, that's the way to go. But they also have a big tradition of what they call musho, which are laments, which took me actually quite often reading them back to Tom Gunn and The Man with Night Sweats, because there was that sort of spare within this sort of incantatory jacket, if you like. There was a sort of spare just getting to the point of what this person who died was about. And so I I wanted to write in that way, and that's what I did, or tried to do. And I've lost my train of thought a bit, but one of the things I wanted to do was write the happy side of Abebe, and actually, because I started to think of Abebe as all boys in Ethiopia. So when I was there and going back quite frequently since then, I've been, this feeling for me is that Abebe is basically every Ethiopian boy. So when I'm writing about my boyhood, I can write about all the other boys there. But what I found so amazing was that even though Ethiopia is a very homophobic country, really, because it is so traditional, so... it's more than homophobic, it's maybe just ignorant. They basically don't have any concept of what it is. I was in 2007, I was with my partner for over 30 years, and I met a lovely poet called Wudalat, who tried to marry me off with her daughter. And then when I said no, with her niece. And my partner Isao was sitting there. And I'm saying, but we're partners. We're lovers. Oh, no, but you must marry my my daughter. It's not too late, she said. I'm going, oh, yeah. I think it's just, there's a lot of ignorance. And she read Ethiopia Boy when it came out, and she sent me the most lovely email to say basically she'd never realised how much one man could love another man. And I think there's a lot of that. I mean, I'm not writing to change Ethiopian attitudes towards homosexuality, but I think any one person you can show, that it's not about sodomy, because that's another interesting thing. The Ethiopian word, the Ethiopian straight word for a homosexual is gebre sodomawi. Gebre is so a lot of people are called. Haile Gebre Selassie or Haile Gebre Mariam or something, meaning, Haile servant or slave of Mary. So Gebre Sodomawi means slave of Sodom, which is quite a, nice way of putting it. Whereas gay people call themselves Zuga, which means citizen. So they're sort of their own citizens in their own country. Rabbited on enough.
Well, that's very good. Thank you, Chris. That's a bit fascinating.
Oh, I wanted to say one more thing.
Yes.
Actually, one of Abebe's friends, when I was sort of sitting in front of him weeping, stupidly, but anyway, he said to me, that's right, I asked him, I thought, well, he was definitely gay, but maybe he had children even if he didn't marry. And he actually said to me, he looked at me very... like, are you stupid or something? And he said, no, Abebe was the father of songs. And I just thought, So, even though they do have this very traditional and the concept of fatherhood is so strong in Ethiopia, but they are willing, with a bit of instruction, to comprehend other types of fatherhood, other types of relationship. That's enough.
Thank you, Chris. Kai, do you want to?
I'll be pretty short, actually. I haven't prepared as much as everyone else. just my lack of preparation. Probably one of the interesting things for me in the title of the panel, 50 Shades of Grey, is that...
Gay.
50 Shades of Gay. probably what we can read as a... it allows for a kind of intersectionality between race and sexuality. If you think about shades and how does shade complicate ideas of gayness or queerness. I'll tell you this odd story, which is a very short thing, but it's just that recently in Jamaica I was talking to a neighbour, and he was telling me about his boredom. He rents a room downstairs, and he tells me in a kind of almost slightly gossipy way. He tells me that his boarder, he says to me, Kai, one night he will take in two women, and the next night he will take in a man. Realizing what he was saying, I said, oh, he's bisexual. And my neighbor said, no, he's just freaky. Which is... But and yet I think that's something quite profound. Because partly, if if you come back to the question, what does it mean to be, for me, a quote-unquote gay poet or a gay writer, I think it means immediately to be framed by another language and by another culture. As soon as you accept that label, you're framing yourself somewhere else, and that's a very complicated thing. In other words, I think what my neighbour is saying is that there's a way in which he can accept transgressive sexualities and expressions of that sexuality, but he can't accept it in another language. The language bisexual was foreign to him, and he couldn't understand. He completely knows that this man is having sex with both men and women, but he doesn't understand it in the terms bisexual. He understands it with the term freaky. As soon as I label myself as a gay writer, in Jamaica that means I have framed myself within the context of a foreign culture. And that's a very complicated thing. And So I think to be the kind of writer I am, when you accept that label, there are all kinds of anxieties that come immediately, because you want to write about your own subjectivity, but what language do you use? And so there's an anxiety of language, there's an anxiety of what is authentic, there's an anxiety all kinds of colonial anxieties. How do you talk about something that is indigenous, something that that your own people will understand? But how do you, so how does one write oneself? With what language does one write oneself? To what audience does one write oneself? I mean, all of these are very complicated questions that you begin to ask when you try to write about a subjectivity that in this culture you might call gay, but in another culture they might know how to accept it, but not with that language. Mm. And I think that's... I think for a writer, that anxiety is a very productive place to live in, because it is an anxiety, but it is an anxiety about language. You have to be creative. You have to navigate various worlds at the same time and try to explain them one to the other. By the way, I mean, to say that is not to say that Jamaica is not a deeply and troublingly homophobic society. It's absolutely not putting that aside, but I think that label, gay writer, in a context that is not this context, can be a problematic label, and it can get you into all kinds of troubles, and you have to navigate that in sometimes very creative and interesting ways. Other than the anxiety about colonialism, the anxiety about language, I think there is an anxiety about genre as well. I know we are talking about poetry here, but I mean, I think I get very, very involved in public discourse in Jamaica. And so what genre do you engage the public in? Sometimes it is not poetry. And therefore, as a gay writer, what is your responsibility? As a gay writer who occasionally has the public ear, what genre do you use to express these different thoughts? So, that's not answering any questions. If you ask me about being a gay writer, those are some of the complicated things that I think immediately.
That's a really interesting answer. I remember when I published a novel called The Colonist many years ago, Eudora Welty welcomed it. It was welcomed as a literary novel. It was about an experience not unlike your experience in Ethiopia, in Mexico. Then it was taken up as an adolescent classic in the States by Laurel Books, and it sold quite well. Mm-hmm. And then Gay Men's Press got hold of it, and it was published as a gay book, and it's been out of print for many years. But what is interesting is that the same book could have three completely different labels affixed to it. And I suppose the Gay Men's Press picked it up because I had begun to teach a course in gay literature. I suppose that's possibly the reason. Mm. Over to you, Rachel.
I don't know quite what I want to say, really. I'm going to attempt to talk myself into something resembling sense. I'm not quite sure where I'm starting.
She's very good at this.
queer poet, lesbian poet. I mean, my problem is always, am I a poet? I'm never quite convinced.
You are.
I'm sort of worthy of that title. I'm conscious in all sorts of ways that I am a person caught between things. And I actually think that's a tremendously creative place to be. I mean, I'm both a woman, but I also carry within me the story of a man. I was someone who was raised as a boy. I'm also a priest. I'm an Anglican priest. And therefore, I represent one of the, you know, one of the dark forces of negativity, really. I'm someone who is conscious very much that I want to identify as a lesbian, yet when I was a man, would I have called myself heterosexual? Being in between is actually, I think, one of the key possibilities for those of us who might identify as LGBT. And what I mean by that is not that... One of the issues, one of the beefs I have, I guess, when I think of myself as a lesbian or as a trans person, is that there's a danger of that being seen as a kind of fixed place. And I think this is one of the challenges and issues for identity politics, you know, which I'm very, you know, I'm very committed to, very active to in church circles. But nonetheless, I think there's a danger of that being seen as a settled place. And that's why I guess queer is a label which I'm drawn to far more, even though, I mean, you told us, Michael, not to get too theoretical.
No, you can
be like, I like that notion of queering as something. I mean, it sounds horribly American, actually, doesn't it? You know, that queering something. But nonetheless, there's something active. And when it comes to my own work as a writer, whether that's in the area of theology or autobiography or poetry, I'm looking for those people, those inspirations, those connections, which are about pushing things out of shape, where language is on the edge of falling apart. I think it's really interesting for me that, you know, I am the only woman on this panel, and of course to be a woman is to be a person who's multiply excluded.
But you're included here.
Just you telling me that, Michael, doesn't mean that I am. No. thank you. Yeah. But sorry, I've lost my chain of thought.
I'm sorry, no,
now. Sorry. It's to be multiply excluded, and I think that those writers who've been significant to me are women who are often negotiating their own understanding of their sexuality, and I'm thinking. I mean. Particularly people like Adrienne Riche, but also, to a certain extent, someone like Marilyn Hacker as well. And I think they actually adopt two quite different strategies, but in the place of transgression. I mean, I think, is it Riche who says something like, you know, we're out in a country where there are no laws, there are no maps, and we're having to find that language. Mm. And, of course, in the most famous poem, Diving into the Wreck, that sense of diving into the histories and not finding ourselves there. Mm. Whereas someone like Marilyn, who, if you haven't come across, I highly commend her. She's a carcanet poet, isn't carcanet, she?
Yes.
But is someone who works with the constraints of form, I think, as a way of negotiating some of the challenges around identity. And
like Chris, she delves into languages. She delves into
absolutely.
Arabic, into French, and so on. Yeah.
So, I mean, that's all I want to say just for the moment, but I'm sure...
But you say something very interesting. I mean, between is one of the words that I was going to draw out. Between cultures. And is it the case that you're uneasy about the term poet, more than gay, perhaps, because there's a formal issue here. You write work which is not in a stable form. You write work which is not poetry, is not necessarily memoir, is not fiction. And I think this note... Is there, if you are between... And you then conform to a form, have you... Sorry, I'm getting all theoretical too, but do you know what I'm trying to say? That you can't, as it were, tell the kind of complex between truth you want to tell as soon as you commit to a form
of history? I would need to think at great length to give any kind of reason, you know, decent answer to that. But my instinct is to say that... I think what's really interesting for me is how... as a poet, I am increasingly in search of form, as it were. And I wonder if that's that sort of sense of the always, I mean, you know, that notion that R.S. Thomas famously talks about how God is always withdrawing.
Yeah.
You know, going into the church and God is already withdrawn. And it's that it's that search for something which is perhaps always fundamentally lost. Mm. But maybe that's the very nature of what it means to be me, as it were. Yeah. Maybe I couldn't dare speak for anyone else, but I think that's true for me.
But Kai, you too write, as it were, in different genres. You write in fiction and poetry. And in fact, your latest book is, in a sense, a dialogue, which could be a dramatic dialogue between two voices, between two, if you like, two dialects. I mean, is this an aspect of your betweenness, if you like? Are you content with being called poet?
Well, I think that's the last thing I say, that it is an anxiety, a genre. Genre never comes easily to me. And I think it's exactly as you say. You know, different truths demand different form. And you're constantly before the writing thinking, what form does this story, does this expression fit? And you're always compressing it into things, because there are genres that are provided for us. There is the poem, there is the essay, there is the novel. Each genre has these demands. You have to press it into that. And probably that's what artistry is about. But yet, especially if you're like me and you move between so many genres, oftentimes you write something and there's a suspicion that you have that the perfect form is something slightly outside the form that you've chosen. and the perfect form does not yet have a name. And the perfect form, if you wrote it in that, it could not be marketed. It could not be published. It just doesn't exist. So how do we apply artistry and shape? You know, what... I'm not sure, because... You know, especially if you're moving in a genre that doesn't exist yet, you know, that gives you all kinds of problems. I mean, one of the bad things I used to do as a poet writing a novel is that how do I say this? I think you can use the toolkit of one genre to accentuate writing in another genre. If you're a poet, you can use that to bring certain kinds of flourishes to your prose. But every genre that you write in has a problem, or every piece of writing that you set out to write, it has a problem. The job of the writer is to identify that problem, or those problems. There are always multiple problems, but let's just pretend there's one. to identify that problem and try as best as you can to fix it. One of the bad things to do, for instance, in my writing, is to use the toolkit of poetry to try to fix the problems of prose. You can't do that. It's cheating, and it doesn't work. What you might end up with is really beautiful writing, but it doesn't fix the problem, because the problems of fiction, for instance, are pace, character, tension. Those are not the problems of poetry. And if you use poetic techniques to fix those problems, then you end up with something that's quite lyrical, but you still haven't solved tension, you still haven't solved character. And so, you know, it's nice writing. So all of that, if you're writing something new, then what are the problems of this new genre? How do you discipline yourself to really think hard about what are the problems of this and how do I fix those problems? You know, it's a very difficult place to...
There is a writer who discovered a new genre, and that was the author of Tender Buttons, the author of Some Americans. It was Gertrude Stein. And her book was very hard to publish, and indeed it took a very long time for it to appear. But she did, in fact, find a new means of writing with a very, very limited diction, with a very repetitive style, I think Adrienne Rich gets quite a lot from her in a kind of oblique way. But, Greg, can we come back to you? I mean, when you did your history of gay poetry... Gay literature. Did you have the sense... I hate to go back to the Elizabethans, but you write extremely well on Sidney. Did you have the sense that writers who had sexual ambivalences or gender ambivalences, whatever, were actually inventing new forms from time to time? Because certainly the Arcadia is a curiously encoding form, which does carry a lot of senses that we read today quite easily, but that were not all that legible at the time.
Yes, and I think we have a problem at the moment with the reading of texts from those periods. I'm slightly wandering from your question. I joined Facebook about a year ago.
You certainly did. He's very eloquent. Befriend him. He has all sorts of things going on his Facebook.
I've been terribly shocked by some of the things that poets say on Facebook.
I'm sorry.
I mean,
do tell.
Poets, you know, really quite interesting, quite well-known poets say, "Oh, I don't like poetry that rhymes." And you just think, well, for Christ's sake, grow up. You know, I don't like formal poetry. I don't read formal poetry. And there appears to be this, I'm coming back to your point, that at the moment there appears to be this sense about, well, poetry before 1900, but I think particularly about earlier poetry, that it is terribly constrained and terribly rule-driven and so on. But no, of course it's not. It's incredibly creative and flexible. And
well, the rules themselves are forms of energy in some cases.
Absolutely. And so, you know, we preen around here and now thinking of ourselves as queering this and queering that. And you just go to, you know, the sonnets. You just go to Sonnet 20. The Master Mistress sonnet, which is the only one in the sonnets that has entirely feminine endings. And you start to think, oh, what's this guy doing with gender here? You know, we think we're so bloody experimental just because we don't rhyme. And or because we're, you know, sort of, we once read Allen Ginsberg. And so, for me, whether writing about gay topics or writing about what other... I don't think there are any topics that are not gay topics. I have to be able to write in all kinds of forms. And to go to old anthologies and so on and find something and think, I want to write a poem that shape, but I want to write it about what I did with that guy last week. Let's see if that works. And it's partly because of my the generation I come from, and because I'm English. I have although I've been out as a gay man since the Stone Age, and I've obviously been out at work and so on, I have all kinds of inhibitions and fears about speaking the unspeakable. About speaking to you lot here, you know, why should I be kind of scared about speaking as a gay writer here? It's because I'm speaking to a room full of strangers and I don't know what each person's opinion is about this topic. To some people, this topic is still literally unspeakable. Mm. And what we're doing is something very kind of poverty-stricken and strange.
Freaky,
yes. Well, freaky in a negative sense, and to others it's freaky in a positive sense. But one of my ways of accessing this whole thing about inhibition, you know, from having grown up in an era when I couldn't talk about it, when I was too embarrassed to say who I was, and also too English, is to go to really, really strict forms. And really terribly difficult rhyme schemes and so on, and try and kind of wreak something out of that, something uncomfortable out of my own discomfort.
You do speak about using form to write about experiences you've had. And when you think about what John Ashbery says about O'Hara, he takes a poem by O'Hara and says, this poem is an instance of itself. In the sense that the poem, O'Hara's poem, is generating its occasion rather than written after its occasion. I mean, I think that one of the things that Gertrude Stein does is to inhabit experience. I mean, she is experiencing as she writes, something Stern does as well when he says, you know, you haven't been listening, woman, go back 3 chapters, we'll wait for you here. And he entertains us while she goes back and reads forward again. But do you find this? When you write, do you write what you know, or do you write to find out what you don't know?
Partly. I mean, maybe I'm going to answer this slightly differently. Partly, I think I write to have some sense of who I am quite a lot of the time. I mean, it's one of those ironies. Again, I think it's one of the perhaps the paradoxes of certainly how I am as a trans person is that on the one hand, there is this profound sense in which I want to say, I know who I am, and I've known this from a very early age, and I want to take all possible ways in order to align who I think my body is with my sort of sense of identity. But perhaps precisely why I think I keep coming back again and again and again to themes of selves or themes of subjectivities is that in the midst of all that, I have no idea who I am most of the time or what experience I'm having. And that there is, I mean, language, without being overly theoretical about it, language is one of is the way in which reality is constructed. There is a sense in which there is no self, there is no experience, there is no identity until it is, in some senses, written. I think it's really interesting if you're a religious person like I am, or certainly an overtly religious person, because I think in Christianity there is that desire to talk about this naturalistic self, you know, that there is this self that one truly is. And so often that's been used as a weapon against queer people, as a way of trying to regulate our behaviour and say, well, you know, you're different. No, you actually need to become this person. But actually, no, identity, writing, experience doesn't work like that.
You, as a love poet...
Love poet.
Do you do anything else apart from love? Well, there's a wonderful line in Don Juan where Gulbayez, the Sultana, says to Don Juan, Christian, canst thou love? It's a wonderful one. Anyway,
do you do anything else apart from love?
And if you love, what are you? What eye are you looking for in the love poems? Is it a past eye? Is it a childhood eye?
I think when I say I'm a love poet, it's that if there's no love in it for me, if there's no sort of passion within me for something that's going on around either in the poem or which which started the poem off, then it just sort of seems to die on me, and I lose interest in my own poem, and that's the most horrible thing that happens. And I know it happens to everybody, but when it happens to you, you think, oh God, you know, and that tends to be because I'm writing something that. Not that didn't happen to me, but that didn't happen to me emotionally. And so, as I was saying before, with Abebe, one of the amazing things I found was that because I was so devastated, and really still am, without any real reason for feeling that, I mean, you know, we didn't have a love affair or anything, but it was just a feeling that Abebe became Ethiopia for me. So everything connected with that was suddenly filled with all this energy. And when I read, you know, a lot of the poetry which I hadn't read before, I was suddenly finding all these different people from not just the Amharas, because I don't know whether you know this, but Ethiopia has about 75 different nationalities in it. That's why they call it an empire. You know, why it had an emperor. And they all speak different languages, and they all have their own poetic traditions. They all, you know, basically inhabit different worlds within the within this one country. And I was just gobsmacked by, you know, the different ways of talking about, you know, an ox, for example, you know, from one part to the other, and the different things that were happening with different oxes in different parts of the country. But in the back of my mind, I always had Abebe there. And so it was like being with somebody that I wanted to be with, and some of the poems don't work, because what I was doing for quite a long time, for a few years, was just thinking, well, you know, I can't write in a sonnet, but what I can do is take this particular ox lament, for example, and writing about my horse, or writing about you know, something Abebe did, or something that, you know, a boy in the street has done, and then see how it works. And I have tried, like I was talking about novels and being in between different genres, I've tried novel writing, and no, not novels, short stories, you know, just couldn't do it at all. So I thought, well, I'd better not try anymore, and stick to something that at least... And I think it was the same problem with me with short stories, is that I wasn't actually interested enough in the plot. I would sort of think for days and weeks, you know, what's the plot of this thing? And I'd get a plot. And in fact, a friend of mine, Patricia Tyrrell, who's a novelist, lives in Cornwall, Newquay, and I said to her, I can't write short stories. How do you do it? And she said, oh, it's easy. You just have two people and they have an argument. And I tried it.
That's your last book of poems. I would love to ask the poets each to read a poem, but I'm not going to, since they're going to be reading dozens of poems later in the evening as I make my way back to Manchester. But I do think we do have perhaps 10 minutes in which we can ask the audience if they have any questions. If not, I'm sure we can return up here. But are there any questions you would like to aim at any particular member of the panel or in general at the panel? Yes.
There is one question that I think probably applies to all of you, hearing what you've all said. That there is a limitation which we all look against, which I think is fundamentally that of language itself. That if you come from different traditions, you have different limitations, probably. So if you are lucky, you can combine different linguistic experiences and expand from that. But I was thinking in terms, really, of Benjamin Britten, the composer, who of course was working in a totally different genre in music. And I'd like to know if you think, when you were talking about whether writing should or can be gay, or whether you're simply a gay writer writing, would you say that Britten produced gay music, for instance? And if so, in what way is it gay? And how would that relate to the idea of writing gay poetry?
That's a really interesting question. I think the main question for me would be, did he invent a new form? And I don't think he did, though his subject matter is often gay. But anyway, where would we like to start? Kai, you haven't spoken for a minute.
I'm all right. Greg?
I'm not sure that I know enough about music, but, I mean, Britten seems to me to be someone who is constantly choosing what you might call gay texts of one kind or another, and has a particular interest in the male voice and kind of intensity of emotion between men that you often don't get with from other operatic composers. So I suppose an answer would be around that, and also the use of his intensive use of boys' voices in particular, and the increasing discomfort there is around his work as a consequence of kind of the increasing taboos around paedophilia. Mm-hmm. I suppose in a way I think that he's an unusual case in that he is a very literary composer. Whereas there are composers who I suppose it would be much less, pure music.
If you have a person using gay themes, they haven't necessarily invented a gay form. I think that's the question I was asking about the gay form. Language, I think, can invent new forms, as Gertrude Stein proves. But in a sense, music is less, possibly less. Able to, you can't speak, even though Hockney is a gay painter and he uses gay motifs, you can't say that is a gay aesthetic, can you? Anyway,
I want to be cautious about overextending my reach in terms of music, but I was listening to the War Requiem again recently, and I was conscious again picking up on the theme there of male text, male voices, and Owen in that particular case. And is there something significant about the character of sublimation in Britten's work? That there is a sense in which they emerge out of a context where this is pre-1967. It is a context where gay identity is very well known, but is perhaps not spoken about, or I mean, in the case of Britain's relationship with Pairs, I mean, everyone knew, but it was not that of which was spoken. And so there's a character of sublimation I find in Britain's work that I don't know if that's a gay form, that makes gay music, but it's, again, it feeds in also to something which I think is true in Owen's writing, which is a tradition of, so now I'm going to start talking utter crap now. The way in which someone like Owen would talk about lads and boys is something which in 19th century poetry, I can't remember any of the names of the poets now, but there's sort of a tradition of writing about lads in a kind of sort of homoerotic way. And I think that, you know, that's just part of that substrate of what Britain is about.
Yeah. I mean, there are two things that I think about in answering that question. One is the limits of the comparison. What adjectives, what genres attach themselves to music or painting in a way that language or language arts don't draw for those kinds of categories. And it has to do with semiotics, that language means and announces things in a way that music does not mean, and that painting necessarily does not mean. And so there are limits to the kinds of ways in which you can be involved in women's writing in a way that you probably can't be as easily involved in women's music or women's painting, because paint and music don't mean in the same way that language means. So I think there's a slight limitation there in the comparison, because language genres are always attaching themselves to categories which become a kind of announcement of the politics that they're exposing in a way that those other genres can't do it. But then we come back to kind of what Gregory said at the beginning, which I find myself sympathetic to those politics. There's something I always want to resist in the subtle idea that by attaching yourself to a category, you've limited yourself. That in being a Jamaican writer, I am necessarily lesser than a world writer, or that in being a gay writer, even though I wouldn't, like, for some reason, gay writing is, I've never announced myself as a gay poet, but I always affirm the right of someone to do that, and to affirm that that's not a limitation. You know, it just matters where you're coming from. So I think there's always something tricky in that kind of idea that that we aspire to. We aspire to lose the adjectives that define us. Though, at the same time, I do understand writers who've always tried to resist that. I mean, in particular, black writers in the 50s and 60s always wanted to not be a black writer. Obviously the comparison was, you know, if you're a black writer, you can only write black literature. And, you know, they wanted to say, no, I'm just a writer. And there was a sense that the term, the adjective, was limiting. And yet I think that when we accept that, we accept the limitation of it. And so there's a tricky politics involved. What is limited, what isn't limited.
Thank you. We have time for one more question back there.
A question for Tom. You touched on the fact that there's quite intense homophobia in Jamaica. I didn't hear you talk much about your profile as a poet, as an artist, in terms of tackling some of those prejudices.
You mean being an activist, in a sense?
Yeah.
I think I've only recently thought of myself as being involved in any kind of activism. You know, I don't. That certainly wouldn't be a label that I use, activist or. Just to give you a brief recap, for instance, last week Sunday there was a huge march in Jamaica, and it mirrors things that are happening in Nigeria, things that are happening in Uganda. It's a kind of heavily... Jamaica suddenly realises that probably the Bogre law discriminates against certain individuals, and so they probably should repeal it. And basically the church just went ape shit in Jamaica. Massive, massive protest. So probably the biggest protest I've ever seen in my life in Jamaica happened last Sunday. From the university all the way to Halfway Tree, you know, just thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And so there's what's happening in Jamaica now is absolutely a moment of hysteria. And I do think that in such moments, I feel a sudden responsibility, not to protest it, but to think publicly, which is what writing for me would be. It is, let me, you know, I mean, probably that's very naive and optimistic and, you know, stupidly nationalistic of me, but, you know, you feel that you have a PhD, you're involved in the world of thoughts, let me take this issue and let me think it through carefully and let me make that thought public, how I'm thinking through things. So one of the easiest things is that I blog. Unfortunately, one of the things that set off all of this was a professor in Jamaica gave testimony in a big case about, about a year ago, but it just went public, where he, as an HIV/AIDS specialist, said that the Bugger Law helped to keep HIV/AIDS infections down. He was fired from the university for that because that goes against all medical evidence. The church reacted against it, said that they fired a good professor just because he held on to his beliefs. This man happens to be my godfather, the professor. And so I ended up being in a strange place where I understood both sides absolutely. And I thought in that I had to risk it. I had to say, listen, I love this man. I know this man. This is why he said what he said. This is how we should read it. And this is what's wrong with it. That went viral. So it's a strange moment where I am very much involved in that public debate. I think that's all you can do. I mean, that's all I can offer. I can offer the moment to understand both sides, to have grown up in the church in Jamaica, to be very sympathetic to that world, and not be snarky or condescending or unloving when you talk about it, but to just think carefully through the matter.
Well, thank you, Kai, and thank you all for this interesting discussion. And I hope you'll all come back this evening to the reading, which will be a wonderful experience. And thank you very much.